When you think of Utah's Pride Festival, you probably imagine dancing and glitter and rainbows, a celebration. This year was no different.
Hi, Brian.
Except that a few days before the festivities began, a group of concerned members of the LGBTQ community called for the removal of two parade entries they viewed as problematic. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. The group refers to themselves as Queers Divest, and they sent a letter with signatures of support to the Utah Pride Center leadership, featuring two specific demands: that the Utah Pride Center immediately divest from Chase Bank and Wells Fargo, as well as retract their parade entries for the 2018 Pride season and the indefinite future, and that the center re-examine its board of directors, its personal lack of diversity on that board, and the practices used to appoint their board immediately. Queers Divest marched in the Pride Parade ahead of the corporate sponsors and planned a brief protest for the route. Before the parade started, I ran into a couple of supporters of the letter.
My name's Lauren Wood. I am here as a community member, as a very long-term out and proud queer individual in the community in Salt Lake, and I'm also part of a group called Wasatch Rising Tide, which mainly focuses on climate justice.
I asked Wood why they were there to march with Queers Divest.
So Queers Divest is not necessarily as much of a organized group as it was an ad hoc amalgamation of community organizers, activists, and queer individuals in the community who feel like there's a disconnect between a lot of the most marginalized members of our community and some of the institutions who are doing the best work at trying to support and resource those individuals. So we tried to start a pretty gentle dialogue in a public sphere through an open letter and petition asking the Utah Pride Center to primarily divest from Wells Fargo and Chase Bank. We ultimately felt like, you know, if these major institutions want to keep giving the Pride Center money for basic resources, that's great. But ultimately, we do not want to continue to give them a free platform to publicize their brand, because ultimately they are antithetical to what it means to be in solidarity with LGBTQ community, specifically the most marginalized members.
Wood says the values of Wells Fargo and Chase Bank don't particularly align with the interests of the LGBTQ community.
I mean, I think that there's been a lot of press in the news recently about Wells Fargo's shady lending practices and discriminatory lending practices, specifically with communities of color and low-income communities. They've been trying to answer a lot to that recently and are trying to backpedal a lot and show up for the community through their philanthropy, which can be commended, but ultimately they're a multinational corporation that exists to make more money in a capitalist structure. And because of that, and because our capitalist structure is based on the abuse of low-income communities' bodies and labor, and is fueling the climate crisis through projects like Dakota Access and Keystone and Peabody Coal Mine on Black Mesa, all of these projects are funded in large part by Wells Fargo, Chase, and other multinational institutions. So we're here to call them out.
Carl Moore from Pandos, a Native American-led organization with a focus on environmental and human rights, stressed the impact of the bank's actions on Native people as stewards of the land.
My name is Carl Moore, and I'm the chairperson of Pandos. We are in support of this march, this coalition, for the purpose of divestment of Wells Fargo and Chase Bank, because what they do specifically towards the Native American people in violating our sacred lands by providing the funds for pipelines. You know, like Lauren said, Dakota Access Pipeline, Keystone Pipeline. Though that's an infrastructure that abuses us. I mean, basically they're raping Mother Earth to extract these things at the cost of our sacred land and also for our health. You know, because our environment, we have a shared environment.
The Queers Divest demonstration took place on 2nd South outside of Bar X. For about 5 minutes, protesters laid still on the street. Moore walked around the circle of participants with a drum, chanting. And like that, it was over, and the parade kept moving. But the conversation didn't end there. Recently, I had the chance to talk with the Utah Pride Center's new executive director, Rob Mulman. Mulman started the job in April 2018. As a gay man teaching school in South Africa, being
the gay teacher at the school
in a very traditional environment was at times challenging. But his activism took root when he moved to Australia to pursue a PhD. It was there that Mulman worked on a project focusing on the experience of LGBTQ youth in what's already a difficult space for teens.
The locker room. And we looked at how school PE teachers and how school sports leaders and sports captains could help make that very awkward space, which is awkward for any kid. I mean,
right.
Let's face it. It's a
it's
terrible
no
space
one's
for
favorite
anyone.
Room.
It's no one's favorite room at all. But how you could make those sorts of spaces far more inclusive for LGBTQ individuals, and also think around the sport. I mean, sport is such an important component to anyone's physical development and understandings of a variety of different things like teamwork and hard work and dedication. So we were finding, and that the academic research was finding, that lots of LGBTQ kids were dropping out of sport for a number of reasons, because it was either a really hyper macho environment, or because of the cloakrooms, or because there was no recognition of their own identity. So we did this amazing program, and I worked on it and took it into schools, looking at how schools could start to develop far more inclusive cultures. And we brought together young people from the school. We brought together the leadership, so principals and deputy principals and well-being coordinators. We brought together other teachers, the PE and the sports teachers, and we sat them all down in a room, and we did this amazing strategic planning. And what was fantastic about this was that it started out in the, essentially, as I said, in the locker rooms and on the sports fields, but the young people very quickly said, this is rubbish. Why are we doing this here and not in the rest of the school? So it just organically morphed across the school. And what was fabulous was it started out in the LGBTQ space, but it very quickly moved on. You know, this was in Australia, as I said, to working with what are we doing for our immigrant population? What are we doing for our first generation Australians? What are we doing for a variety of different other groups that are generally not often seen and sometimes right. marginalized in a school? And this program was one of the most exciting things I think I've done, because it was just so rigorous and so thorough. So that's where I then worked, and I was finishing a PhD. And then my partner got transferred here to Salt Lake City, and we sort of went, what? Salt Lake City?
Where?
No, we knew where it was. We're not such yobos. We knew where it was, but we were understandably, I think, quite anxious about moving to Salt Lake City, because, you know, as is the case with any strange country or place that you don't know very much about, you grab whatever the headlines are. And the headlines outside of Utah about Salt Lake City were not necessarily kind. It was after Prop 8. It was after, mm-hmm. You know, some of the other decisions. It was we were making the decision to move after the declaration around the same-sex attracted parents in the mm-hmm. church. So a lot of our friends said, sheesh, good luck. I hope it goes well. And we said, no, don't worry. We'll just be there. It's just 3 years. It's a really good career move. We're going to, you know, we'll learn to ski. It'll be fine. We'll be fine. Anyway, and the long and the short of it is our 3 years run up at the end of this year, but neither of us have got any plans of leaving. So we've loved it.
It's Mulman's first Utah Pride celebration as executive director, and he wasn't expecting the message from Queers Divest, especially not the tone he perceived from it.
My reaction to it was something that we probably shouldn't be saying on the radio at any point.
No expletives, please.
No, you know what? It was, I'm trying to think of that first moment when I got the letter. I was quite anxious about what it would contain and to what degree the group was going to be happy to sit down and talk. Because I don't think that there's any situation that is ever going to be solved if there are definites and if there is no space for dialogue and there's no space for understanding. So that was my first reading of that letter. And on that first reading of the letter, you would have read that in there. I don't have the letter in front of me now, but I do remember the last paragraph. The first line was something along the lines of, we look forward to, at the end of the week, hearing that you have divested. And that was it. And I read that and I thought, oh, is that an ultimatum? and what would happen next. So there was this sense of confusion. There was a sense of frustration that it initially felt like something that was a done deal. It is that or else. Mm-hmm. So that was quite frustrating. It was also frustrating to see that there were people who had signed on to the letter that I had such huge respect for. So to see that made me a little bit, it threw me a little bit, and because they were people that I had hoped and thought that I had was starting to build a good relationship with.
There were also some people from the Pride Center who had signed on to the letter.
Yeah, those are the people that I'm talking about. Yeah. I think the thing about the space that we work in, and particularly this space of LGBTQ activism and LGBTQ environment, is one where it is imperative that we take the time to sit and listen and realize that the issues are complex and intertwined and interesting, and that they cannot all be just brushed under the carpet. So what I was quite thankful for, and in retrospect quite thankful for, was that I had easy access to talking to the people who had been part of setting up that letter and writing it. So I was able to say, hey, can you come in here, just help me understand this? And once I was able to do that, and I realized that the intent and the writing of the letter was so completely different from the willingness to engage and the eagerness to sort of sit and think around these issues and discuss different ways by which the Pride Center, I suppose, could help think through the issues with them or talk through the issues with them. And it wasn't as much an us versus them situation as I had initially thought, but it was in fact a situation that came from a place of care, that came from a place of concern. It was one of the moments when I breathed a sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm. Mulman says his first step, after connecting with the center's employees who had signed on to the letter, was to meet with representatives from Wells Fargo and Chase Bank. He gave them three options.
I said the options, you know, that I saw for them, they were really threefold. We carry on. I said I'd like them to consider maybe withdrawing their Wells Fargo or their corporate sponsorship and maybe just have the ERGs walk. Or, of course, they could walk away completely if that's what they chose to do. So those are the three sort of options that I presented. And
did they seem to understand the concerns from the letter writers?
Yeah, absolutely. The counter to it, of course, from their perspective, is that this is a local bank with local employees and a bank, or banks, both of those banks, that had done a lot to further the cause of the LGBT communities. So some of those banks had been early supporters of the Pride Festival. They'd early financial supporters as well from many years back. They had made changes in their domestic partnership rules. They'd made changes around employee resource groups. There'd been significant strides in both of those banks. And I think, and in many banks, sorry, I don't know why we're picking on just those two. And that becomes part of the issue is that, you know, once you start to single out one corporate over another corporate, it becomes a really sort of a weird slippery slope that you start to move down. And that was one of my concerns, is that we didn't have an overarching protocol of who we let into the parade and who can't come in and why can't they participate. So to suddenly 3 days before go, well, we've changed the rules today, it sat very uncomfortably with me. So, you know, the banks and the corporates are focusing, and that's where I want to focus, is on the employees and the groups that the employees that they have who want to march, who are now out. I mean, think about, you know, I want to say 20 years ago, but forget 20 years ago, 10 years ago, we were calling for corporates. That was part of our movement, was to say to people, come out, come out. It is okay. Be out at work, be there, and work should support you, and et cetera. So that's part of the drive that we've had.
The banks decided to keep their entry in the parade. Mulman then met with folks from Queers Divest and agreed to release a statement detailing his efforts and march in the parade alongside the protesters. Mulman says, though, that the root cause of the letter writer's concerns is a complex one to understand.
I think the underlying issue is something far more complex than just let's boycott these two banks. I think the underlying issue is a far broader one, And it is about the recognition of two things. So I would say the first being that there are many, many groups and individuals that are marginalized or silenced or oppressed to a certain degree that are outside of the fringe and outside of the media space and outside of, you know, what's constantly put in our faces on Facebook or whatever. And then it becomes more complicated because even within those groups, there are members of our LGBTQ community who are suffering the same sort of situation. And I think that broadly, we as a community need to understand and make space for those voices. The issue of the banks is a nice one because, I mean, it's a clear one because there's a clear line that gets drawn. This happened, therefore we must do something. But I think that the underlying issues are far more complex. And it's, you know, it boils down to, you know, some of the great thinkers, the Mandelas and the Lords and the Martin Luther Kings, et cetera. Excuse me. I'll talk about it. The oppression of one is the oppression of all. And so I think that it's one of those situations that is not easily resolvable in 4 days. And by say, that's what I mean. I mean, there are things that we can do, we can put in place, we can draw attention to these issues. We should be drawing attention to these issues. I mean, the Pride Center exists because people many, many years ago have worked really, really, really hard to make sure that the LGBT causes issues have been highlighted. So, you know, we're now digging down into sort of that next level. So I think that it's imperative that we allow that space, that we think about those things, and we try our very best to constantly be aware of and take action for people who can't do it for themselves.
But what about the question of funding? It's something every nonprofit organization has to think about. Big companies might not always have a spotless record on its treatment of LGBTQ people, or the environment, or any number of social questions. Does he draw a line between who can sponsor or march in the very lucrative Pride Parade?
We're not going to let, oh God, I don't even believe I'm going to say this, but like, for example, a company that would be more difficult for me to allow entry into a parade would be one like Chick-fil-A, because it has a history of not respecting LGBTQ diversity and inclusivity, and has actual blatant history of being rather disrespectful of it. So yes, we don't have a policy of letting all and sundry march in our parade, and we can do that. But you know, these banks, if you look at some of the policies, if we try to sort of think around what they've done, yeah, they have a legitimate right to walk as employees. The trick becomes, of course, now you look at the corporate sort of work that they do. So that becomes the real nub of the whole discussion, I think, because the corporate experience and the corporate activities are ones that are, in these two cases, helping to marginalize communities even further. So that becomes tricky. The question that you then posed was, so I think that's the inclusive work that they're doing. The space that they've made for their employees is fantastic. You know, there's still work to be done, but there's good work that has been done. You then asked around the donations that they make. So those donations that they make, well, any donations at any of the whole Pride Festival is, you know, to some people it's a great celebration. And it's a fabulous celebration. We have the march and protest and the rally. So we've got that rally element. We've got the celebration element. To our mental health staff, the Pride Festival is suicide awareness and suicide prevention. That's how they see the key reason for it being. And that they see it as imperative because it allows people to come in and see themselves and to see their community and to be in their community, particularly in a state like Utah, where that's not always possible and or easy. So there are three. Yeah. And then the third element is, of course, to me, one of the key things is it's a fundraiser. It keeps the doors open. And it's one of our biggest, it is our biggest fundraiser in order to keep the center open. And that is through donations, it's through ticket sales, it's through sponsorships. And any of those donations go to our mental health, our critical mental health services that happen at the center. We've got a youth space where we've got young people from 2 to 20 who come through the space. We have got PFLAG parents. We've got parent groups. We've got trans groups. We've got, it's just a huge variety of different activities and events. And I was talking to somebody this morning around Gender Revolution, a conference that we host. We host Queer Continuum, a conference. So these things are vital to what we believe the healthy, engaged LGBTQ community is. And they don't come for free. So you've got to pay for them somehow. Now, are there ways that we can start to think around how are there different places we can get cash from? Are there different ways we can engage a sponsorship base? Are there different ways we can look at membership programs? Of course there are. And I think any organization is constantly looking for new ways to fund itself, any organization like ours. But the reality is that that's where we are at this point. We're in the process of reconsidering a set of protocols for what it would look like. We have to consider what the parade looks like next year, because 160 parade entries is not going to happen again. It's just completely unfeasible. So there's some really interesting and I think quite exciting discussions around what we can do to make sure that we have a great, fabulous parade. So that's going to be happening in the near future. And that's what's come out of this discussion with Queers Divest, is that we'll be sitting down, we'll have a look at a set of protocols for groups or peoples that we will would be part of a parade. And we'd also really, we have known for a long time that we need to reconsider what this parade actually looks like.
Mm-hmm. Maybe more of a protest, perhaps. I don't know. I always hear that, that's how Pride kind of started, was as a protest of unfair discrimination in the community. Yeah. The second concern of Queers Divest was a perceived lack of representation on the Utah Pride Center's board of directors for an increasingly diverse LGBTQ community, which, they said, was due to unfair appointment practices. I asked Mulman to describe the process of selecting board members.
Yes, I think there is distinct confusion as to what that process is. And I think that that's in the first letter that I put out, or the first response that I put out, I was quite clear about the fact that there was a tremendous amount of misinformation in the first Queers Divest, in the Queers Divest protest. And our board is an interesting one. I'm hesitant about speaking about the board and for the board. Even though I have been on it, I'm certainly not there anymore. So there are two ways to become a member of our board. We have an open call. There is a space on our website where anybody can apply for the board. So you submit your application. The applications are taken in and really only considered towards the end of the year when we're doing the call for board members. But anyone can apply. We've had that up for certainly since when our new website went up. So that's January. But prior to that, it was an email situation, but there is an open link on our webpage. And then, of course, as is the case with any other board, it's about trying to find and recruit members. So there's a sort of two-pronged approach which happens. Within that, the board is constantly looking for new, trying to make sure that they have the required skills and, I suppose, the required skills that are needed. And I think our board does it's a difficult job, not always been perfect, but our board currently has somebody who is trans, somebody who's intersex, somebody who's gay, or a couple of lesbians. We've got non-binary. We've got some of our Latino members have just termed off. So we're looking certainly for some more Latino members of our community to be on the board. We've got one person of color. It's an interesting situation because it's, how do we start to, when we say we're, got to make sure that you've got the right people, mm-hmm. which I think our board definitely has. It was a joy working with them in my term on the board. But at the same time, making sure that there's no tokenism that starts to creep in.
Mulman says he can't speak on behalf of the board, but hopes, through his role as executive director, to create a welcoming space for new people and those who have strayed from the Pride Center in the past.
What I know that we are wanting to work on, and I'm going to talk from a center perspective, is that there is a lack of, and I'm talking within the center, not necessarily the board, so I'm digressing a little bit, is that we as a center struggle to and have struggled historically to bring people of color into the center, bring the Latino community into the center, the indigenous community into the center, the individuals with disabilities. So that's one of my big goals, is to either bring them in, or more importantly, is for us to reach out and say, hey, how can we help you? You know, you realize that in your communities, you know, you got these LGBT people. We know a little bit about that. You know more about your community. How can we work together to actually develop a program, an event, whatever it is? And it's my hope that through that and through that reaching out, that instead of it being a case of us going out to look for people, you're going to have people who are coming to the center and who are saying, hey, you know what? I could bring you this perspective. I could help you with this. You seem engaged. You seem interested. Can we come in? And I'm hoping that through my work and the group's work in the center, that we're able to help the board find individuals that would work and be fabulous representatives for their communities, fabulous representatives for their identities on our board. So, you know, that's the work that I can do now in that respect. And we've made some good strides. We've had, certainly in my very short time as being part of the executive leadership there, we've had some great connections already with a variety of different groups, from Black Lives Matter through to we've recently got a new Latino staff member who's going to help me reach out to a group that they've been involved in for a long time. So it really is about making those personal connections and getting those mm-hmm. personal relationships established.
So that's part of your vision, I guess.
Your
vision to hopefully include and reach out to and go to their communities, people of color, people with disabilities, poor people.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely part of our mission. You know, we keep talking about being a community center, and we actually need most of the community to be there. And we've got a lot of our communities coming back. I've had some lovely moments of people coming to me and saying, that they, you know, they haven't been that involved in the past, or they haven't been that keen on what's been happening, but there's been this joy and revitalization of the Pride Center over the last few months, certainly since Carol Gennardi took over, kind of, you know, creating the space and this new center and focusing on that has enabled me to really take this place and say it is now something for all. You know, it's an exciting and rather daunting position to be in.
That was Rob Mulman, Executive Director at the Utah Pride Center. What's the role of a nonprofit advocacy group like Pride in your community? Tell us at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback. Special thanks to Roger McDonough and the rest of the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.